as food, or its equivalent money, is not the principal object of their existence, they have at last time to serve the light. That is to say, they are in a position in which they can reflect at their leisure and begin to reach towards this strange and marvelous life of the mind. Now, with the dissolution of the body, at least one desperate clamorous need has gone from us. We do not any longer require the 3 or 4 meals a day that were of 25. Such excessive importance. One primal factor in earth life is eliminated, and that is hunger. But we have other factors of great importance to consider. After hunger there comes sex. Has this need also disappeared with the dissolution of the body? I think my answer, in most cases, should be in the negative. It has not disappeared, but it is changed. And here we come face to face with one of the great problems in this period of transition. First, it is necessary to attempt some definition of sexual desire. It takes many forms. Some of these are perverted. Let us deal with these perversions, and, in so doing, we shall deal with what man calls sin. Cruelty perhaps cuts more deeply into human nature than any other sex perversion. It marks the human soul, scars it more deeply than almost any other vice. The cruel man who has changed his natural craving for affection into a longing to give pain to others necessarily finds himself in a world here where he cannot satisfy this craving. He has pandered to it during all his earth life, and so it has become an integral part of his soul. In the new life he has not, for a time at any rate, the power to inflict pain on anything living. This means for him, with his greatly increased mental powers, a very terrible distress. He goes about seeking whom he may devour and finding naught. The misery of such an unsatisfied state is largely the mental character. What use to him is a world of light and beauty while still this foul earth longing is unsatisfied? For him there is only one release from his mental purgatory. And until he can find a way of escape, until there is an actual change in his cold, cruel soul, he will remain in outer darkness. Christ spoke of that outer darkness as being the lot of sinners. By this saying, he did not imply darkness as we know it, the darkness recognized by the senses. He meant the darkness of soul, a mental distress, a perverted desire that cannot find its satisfaction. 26. Eventually this individual faces up to his own misery, to his vice, and then the great change comes. He is put in touch with a portion of the great memory which Saint John has called the Book of Life. He becomes aware of all the emotions roused in his victims by his acts. He enters into a small part of the mighty superconscious memory of his generation which hovers near the earth. No pain, no anguish he has caused has perished. All has been registered, as a kind of existence that makes him sensible of it. Once he has drifted into touch with the web of memory that clothed his life and the lives of those who came into contact with him on earth. The history of the cruel man in the hereafter would make a book which I am not permitted to write. I can only briefly add that his soul or mind becomes gradually purified through his identification with the sufferings of his victims. I have wandered away from the theme of Tom Jones in order to explain what is meant by Christ's statement that the sinner is cast into outer darkness where there is wailing and gnashing of teeth. It is a mental darkness into which the sinner plunges. His own perverted nature has drawn this suffering upon himself. He had free will, the power to choose, and, temporarily at any rate, he chose this mental darkness in the afterlife. Now, I would give you one more illustration. Let us take for example a man, or if you prefer a woman, who has led an immoral life on earth. Here I may borrow a saying of the angel who appeared to John, "He that is filthy let him be filthy still." The man who comes into this life with a sex history of a reprehensible kind finds, when he enters the kingdom of the mind, that as his mental perceptions are sharpened so his predominant earth desire is intensified, his mental power being far more considerable. He can, at will, summon to himself Reverend 22. 11. 27. Those who will gratify this overdeveloped side of his nature. Others of his kind gravitate to him. And for a time these beings live in a sex paradise. But bear in mind that it is created by their mental makeup, by their memories and their imagination. They yearn still for gross sensation, not for that finer life, which is the spirit of sexual love, that perfect comradeship without the gratification of the grosser feelings. They obtain it in abundance, and there follows a horrible satiety. They come to loathe what they can obtain in excess and with ease, and then they find it extraordinarily difficult to escape from those who share these pleasures with them. A murderer comes into the category of such men. It is a sudden perverted desire, a lust for cruelty which leads in many cases to murder. The last state in Illusion Land might be termed the purgatorial state. Obviously, it is extremely painful to realize the misery of satiety, to come to the end of the desired pleasure. There is one greater misfortune than the non-realization of the heart's desire, and that is its realization. For human beings are so constituted that they are almost invariably seeking a false dream, a will-o'-the-wisp, and no permanent content can be obtained from its fulfillment. It is, of course, impossible to lay down an iron rule. Each individual has a different experience from each other individual in Hades and Illusion Land. In certain cases he is not given the power to satisfy his desires. Actually, he is able to do so, but his own ego does not permit such satisfaction. For instance, the cold selfish man in Illusion Land may dwell in darkness, for it is not within the power of his ego to throw itself outwards, to express itself in the fantasy of fulfilled desires. He is thrown more than ever inwards by the shock of death. He believes he has lost everything. He loses contact with all except the sense of his own thinking existence. A nightmare of darkness prevails. 28. For a time, prevails as long as he lives within his morbid sense of loss, within his desire, which is merely to gratify himself without any regard for others. There may be only night in Illusion Land for the abnormally selfish man. Nearly every soul lives for a time in the state of illusion. The large majority of human beings when they die are dominated by the conception that substance is reality, that their particular experience of substance is the only reality. They are not prepared for an immediate and complete change of outlook. They passionately yearn for familiar though idealized surroundings. Their will to live is merely to live, therefore, in the past. So they enter the dream I call Illusion Land. For instance, Tom Jones, who represents the unthinking man in the street, will desire a glorified brick villa in a glorified Brighton. So he finds himself the proud possessor of that 20th century atrocity. He naturally gravitates towards his acquaintances, all those who were of a like mind. On earth he longed for a superior brand of cigar. He can have the experience ad nauseam of smoking this brand. He wanted to play golf, so he plays golf. But he is merely dreaming all the time, or, rather, living within the fantasy created by his strongest desires on earth. After a while this life of pleasure ceases to amuse and content him. Then he begins to think and long for the unknown, long for a new life. He is at last prepared to make the leap in evolution, and this cloudy dream vanishes. 29. Chapter 4. Consciousness on Earth. Consciousness is as a lamp lit each morning when you awake. If you are in poor health the flame is feeble, if you are young and vigorous it flares up and seems to illumine every material object you meet, giving to it a special and happy radiance. This daily consciousness changes according to age and experience. From one year's end to another it is never quite the same, though you probably do not note its almost imperceptible changes. It is that ego which sees, touches, hears and is aware of the material world. I have already told you that this fantastic being is a sum in arithmetic. After death, and after the stages of transition, that ego, with certain important changes, again resumes its sway. Whatever the plane of being on which it arrives, it is now a traveler who has discarded flesh and blood, the brain cells, the intricate web of nerves which brought unity and proportion to the body, which made of it a kingdom. In its place there is a very much finer shape. This shape also possesses its means of communication, and these feed the whole of the new structure of very subtle atoms. It is, as I have said, a structure so rare, so fine, that it is invisible to the mortal eye and eludes the finest instruments of the scientists. Actual pain is not felt in any of the parts of this new image of man. For now the mind has greatly increased powers, and though it may experience pain in the spiritual or intellectual sense, Such is its control of its outward form on the fourth plane that form cannot hurt it in the earthly or physical sense, cannot be, in any respect, the ruler. You will realize, therefore, that an important advance has been made. On the other hand, man has still to pass through many states, to experience numberless lives before he draws near the goal, before he reaches out towards fulfillment. Roughly, I may define his consciousness for the greater part of his journey as follows: spirit or higher soul, ego or lower soul, and their manifestation in form. There is also what I might call the ladder of consciousness. The rungs of the ladder represent the various lives from the alleged beginning to the final achievement, though it is not for me to say that there is any finality. When I use the term final, I merely desire to indicate the limits of my vision. Now the soul or ego is the actual self or surface awareness on each rung of the ladder, the spirit is the light from above. It illumines every rung of the ladder, embraces the whole. The soul, then, is merely the part, the gatherer of experience, the representative of the mystery behind all life. The higher the ego climbs on the ladder of consciousness, the nearer it draws to other kindred souls. I have already told you that there may be 1,000, 100, or merely 20 souls all fed by one spirit. Their consciousness of comrade souls increases on the higher levels of existence. In time they are able to enter into the other soul's memories, perceive their experiences and be sensible of them as if they were theirs. Mind becomes communal in the last stages, for the spirit, the unifying principle, is tending all the time to produce greater harmony, and therefore greater unity. These various individuals emerging more and more, becoming one in experience and in mind, and thus attaining to undreamt of levels of intellectual power. On the lower rungs of this ladder of consciousness dwell those souls who still cling to human habits of thought, to the earthly personality, to their own individual line of thought. On earth some of them have been extremely learned. But knowledge does not make a wise man. A great Indian yogi, a Chinese sage, a learned or holy Christian father may dwell for eons of time within the third and fourth superterrestrial states. They are typical representatives of soul man, and they have his shortcomings. They cling to the line of thought which was theirs on earth, and so they remain sadly individualized in it. They are caught in its dream, and are snared in the many errors thereof. For instance, the Indian yogi and the Chinese sage may still seek only to follow the aspiration of their particular religion or philosophy, the freeing of the soul from matter, ecstatic contemplation of the universe. They appear to gain their aspiration, but in consequence they abide merely on one of the lower rungs of the ladder. They believe that they have attained to nirvana, that they have passed out yonder, entered into the mystery of God. But they have done nothing of the kind, for they are still individualized, still clinging to their blissful little dream created when they were on earth. They are living in the stagnant bond. They are progressing neither up nor down. They have no contact with the material aspect of the universe, and their state of alleged ecstatic contemplation narrows and limits experience, confines them still in the prison of their own ego. I remarked before that when souls reached to the higher rungs of the ladder they became merged in the unifying spirit, and might at last journey out yonder, enter into the mystery of God. In so doing they slough form and no longer express themselves in an outward appearance. But those spirits who pass out yonder do not dwell in ecstatic contemplation as does the sage or the yogi. They are, though formless, in contact with the whole of the material universe, an incredible activity of a spiritual and intellectual kind as theirs. For now they share in the timeless mystery, now they are in the true nirvana, in the highest Christian heaven. They know and experience the Alpha and Omega of the material universe. The chronicle of all planetary life, the history of the Earth from the beginning to the end are theirs. Truly they are not merely heirs, they have become inheritors, indeed and in truth, of eternal life. You are, as you climb the long ladder of consciousness, a sum in arithmetic. When you pass out yonder you become the whole. The spirit, which lights up the ladder, is an individualized thought of God, a thought that may dwell within its own life, or that may still be in intense and direct contact with God when that thought contacts directly the human ego. A spirit man is a human being of whom perhaps a few score have appeared on Earth since time began. He differs from others in that his spirit retains that intense and direct inspiration from God when it enters into time and communicates with the incarnate man. Therefore, spirit man alone has expressed eternal truth, either in his life or in his words. When his physical body dies, he dwells in Hades, but he does not tarry in illusion land. Swiftly he passes up the rungs of a ladder, easily may he become one with the Father. For even while on earth he has known the Father, having drawn his inspiration from the imagination of God. Chapter 5. The Plane of Color. The Fourth Plane. The Soul Man. The Breaking of the Image in Illusion Land. You wear an etheric body. It is of a finer or more tenuous matter than the physical form. If you belong to the second class, if you are a soul man, in other words an intelligent, ethically developed soul, you will desire to go up the ladder of consciousness. The longing for a physical existence will have been burned into ashes with, however, a few exceptions. Certain soul men desire to return to Earth, or wish, at any rate, for some planetary existence wherein they may achieve some intellectual triumph, or wherein they may play a notable part in the strife of earthly or planetary life. These, then, become incarnate again. But the majority of soul men slough their etheric body and put on a shape which is a degree finer. They are then released from illusion land, from that nursery in which they merely lived in the old fantasy of Earth. Now, these beings wear a subtle body and they enter a world I would call super-terrestrial, for they still abide within the ether. Ether is a bad term, but I cannot find another word to define that air, or, I would rather say, fluid or emanation which is of the material universe. Pray remember that ether is the ancestor of matter as you know it. But I am wandering from my theme. As long as soul man would live mainly in form, he must be content to be a super-terrestrial being. That state contains many degrees, many vehicles of expression. They differ in the rates of vibration. The finer they are, the greater your spiritual and intellectual perceptions, the wider your grasp, the loftier your experience of that mystery we call God, the goal of all spiritual attainment. Now, in the state beyond illusion, when you are living consciously and are sensible of your subtle body, you dwell in a world which is the original of the earth. Briefly, the earth is an ugly smudged copy of the world wherein dwells the subtle soul in its subtle body. You are doubtless aware that the copyist, when he produces his painting of a masterpiece, usually fails through being unable to convey the soul of the work in question. The measurements may be correct, coloring and line excellent, but the life is not within it, so you are left cold and aloof. You are merely stirred to a petty irritation when you perceive a copy of an old master you loved. The earth, as you know it, is this unreal thing, a copy of a masterpiece. It is a shadow with all the defects of a shadow. It is, at times, distorted and grotesque, at times, a mere dim outline. Animation is absent. The true life is not expressed in it. Within the subtle world of which I speak, you will perceive a variety of forms which are not known on earth and therefore may not be expressed in words, yet there is a certain similarity, a correspondence between the appearances of nature and the appearances on this luminiferous plane. Flowers are there, but these are in shapes unknown to you, exquisite in color, radiant with light. Such colors, such lights are not contained within any earthly octave, are expressed by us in thoughts and not in words. For, as I previously remarked, words are for us obsolete. However, the soul, in this plane of consciousness, must struggle and labor, no sorrow but not earth sorrow, no ecstasy but not earth ecstasy. The sorrow is of a spiritual character. The ecstasy is of a spiritual kind. These two transcend imagination, but they finally lead the soul to the borders of the super-terrestrial region. A chapter in Superlatives. The apotheosis of form. The soul becomes possessed of a new awareness as well as of finer perceptions when he decides to go upwards rather than downwards on the ladder of consciousness, and, therefore, he enters the fourth plane of being. On earth the average man's normal ego is largely controlled by the body's desires, though the spirit inspires its life and at times lights up the darkness of the human brain with luminous flashes. Still, the spirit, or what I call the deeper mind, can only faintly impress itself upon the ego. Now, In the fourth stage, the spirit is able to enter, with greater intensity, into the time measurement which I call the soul or ordinary consciousness. This soul becomes sensible of the change through his greatly increased intellectual powers. With that increased awareness there comes greater concentration. The memory of the earth life, in its details, is for the time being lost. As long as the soul dwells in form, he is subject to the rhythm of the universe and, therefore, to some form of time. Conceive time and appearance as one symbol. The soul bears with him, however, the fundamental emotional memory, or rather retains contact with it in the first stage on the fourth plane of life. This plane of color might be more aptly termed the breaking of the image. For on this level of consciousness the soul learns how to control form, learns by myriad experiences the ghostliness of all substance. In the anterior period of his evolution he has been controlled largely by substance. Slowly the graven image is broken, slowly the ego learns so to draw from the higher soul or spirit that he can, at will, break up his form and break from all forms, all appearances about him. Of course, each individual's experiences vary enormously. I take as my example a sensitive soul man who makes definite progress upwards, who does not, as do so many, journey with the undulatory motion of a sea wave, up and down, though always reaching a little in higher than before. Now this sensitive soul man realizes first of all that he has entered a world of myriad colors, lights and sounds. He is sensible of a body entirely dissimilar from the human body. As regards appearance, it can only be described as being apparently a compound of light and colors unimaginable. The shape of this form is influenced by all the ego's past acts so far as they have impressed themselves on his deeper consciousness. This colored compound may be grotesque, bizarre in form, may be lovely beyond words, may possess strange absurdities of outline, or may transcend the loftiest dream of earthly beauty. In this many-colored region the form vibrates with extreme intensity, for now mind expresses itself more directly in form, so that we can hear the thoughts of other souls. At first only one at a time may break upon that hearing. But after a while we become sensible of the fact that we may hear the thoughts of several souls, each apart and distinct from the other. We dwell in a world of appearances in some respects similar to the earth. Only all this vast region of appearances is gigantic in conception, terrifying and exquisite according to the manner in which it presents itself to the soul man. It is far more fluidic, less apparently solid than earth's surroundings. This many-colored world is nourished by light and life in a greater purity, vibrates at an unimaginable speed. The souls, who dwell within the first zone, realize that with increased consciousness they have gained the far greater sensitivity. A hostile soul man's mentality may, with a powerful projection of thought, blast and wither some part of your body of light and color. You have to learn how to send out protecting rays. If on earth some other man or woman was your enemy and you hated one another bitterly, you will encounter this man or woman on this luminiferous plane. The old emotional memory will awaken when you meet. For love and hate draw you inevitably towards those souls who are in the pattern of your particular design, which is ever shaping and reshaping in the tapestry of eternity. You will understand, therefore, that pain and pleasure, joy and despair are once more experienced. Again, however, they differ greatly from the earthly conception of them. They are of a finer quality, of an intellectualized character. Mightier is their inspiration, more profound the despair they arouse, inconceivable the bliss they stir within the deeps of your being. On this luminiferous plane the struggle increases in intensity, the efforts expended are beyond the measure of earthly experience. But the results of such labor, of such intellectualized and spiritualized toil and battle also transcend the most superb emotion in the life of man. In brief, all experience is refined, heightened, intensified, and the actual zest of living is increased immeasurably. Awareness on the fourth plane. The preceding remarks, outlining a more rarefied existence in the superterrestrial zone, must be regarded as merely a rough tracing of a very varied state of being. For instance, in that more spiritualized state there are many forms of expression. In it the soul wears several bodies, passing from one to another as he advances. These become more and more subtle indeed. The fineness of their texture cannot be grasped or understood by even a super scientist. One law prevails, however: your soul is only aware of those beings who possess bodies vibrating with the same intensity that is, unless he puts himself into a state analogous to that strange sleep known as hypnosis. When thus conditioned, he may go back, temporarily descend a rung of the ladder and make mental contact with a soul who inhabits a denser shape. He can even descend into Hades, enter its fog and come into touch with human beings. He is thereby frequently caught in the dream of the Earth's personality, and it is as if the memory of his experiences on a higher plane were temporarily anesthetized away. So he is incapable of conveying to Earth, save with rare exceptions, any interesting or remarkable information. Caught in the cocoon of Earth memories, which frequently are not his own, he can merely speak of trivial material affairs. It is as if he were a drugged bee in a hive, a bee sated with honey. His awareness on the luminiferous plane has vastly increased, but usually he cannot convey a sense of it to those individuals he may endeavor to contact if he chooses once more, like Orpheus, to go down into hell in search of the beloved. These remarks will explain why so few ever receive any spontaneous impression of the departed. Indeed, men and women are as ghosts to us, and only when they seek us with faith and with love do they obtain any convincing suggestion of ourselves, of our Earth personality. Such a search is legitimate and will neither hurt nor distress the one who is summoned or sought. Now, a human being cannot imagine a new sound, a new color or feeling, so it is impossible for him to conceive the infinite variety of new sounds, colors and feelings experienced by us on the fourth stage, which I have called the breaking of the image. Nearly half of the Earth life is passed in sleep, that is to say, in a state of unconsciousness, and it is calculated that even when man is awake, his normal healthy self, his consciousness is broken by gaps of unconsciousness 40 or 50 to a second. In this respect he resembles a light house that stands upon a rocky coast on a starless night. Darkness impenetrable covers the sea. Every now and then it is lit up by a ray of light which flashes across the waters, illumining their surface but feebly and momentarily. Man's consciousness appears thus to me now. In his journey up the ladder he is gradually emerging from that darkness in the sense that the light becomes brighter, more continuous. When he reaches the fourth stage his awareness is as brilliant as an ordinary man's awareness is feeble. There are far fewer gaps of unconsciousness, for the spirit can make a surer and more consistent contact with the soul by reason of the fineness of its body and its greater subtlety, by reason of increased intellectual activity on his part. The blind puppy is beginning to open his eyes at last. Bray examined the picture of the night sea again. It is almost continually illumined by the beacon of the lighthouse. Only at long intervals does darkness descend. Now how is it possible to convey to human beings, by the primitive rude sounds called words, the implications that arise from this far greater awareness? For instance, the intensity of the thought processes of the emotional life seem limitless when compared with the sluggish movements of the human brain, with the crude passion that is roused in the stirring moments of earth life. Take the intellectual activity of a slug or a snail, compare it with that of a man and you will understand how different is the mental world of the soul on the fourth plane from that of the human being. Our conception of space differs entirely from yours. I can give you a faint glimpse of it if I use the wireless message as an illustration. I have but to concentrate my thought for what you might call a moment and I can build up a likeness of myself, send that likeness speeding across our vast world to a friend, to one, that is, in tune with me. Instantly I appear before that friend though I am remote from him, and my likeness holds speech in thought, remember, not words with this friend. Yet, all the time, I control it from an enormous distance, and as soon as the interview is concluded I withdraw the life of my thought from that image of myself, and it vanishes. Of course, I can only make this contact with those on my plane who are familiar with me and, therefore, were in my rhythm. This trivial illustration of the power of thought to give reality to itself is mentioned here merely in order to show you how much nearer we have come to the creative principle. We are gradually learning how to live within and without form, learning how ghostly is the most tenuous substance. We are becoming aware of the fluid, flowing character of mind. We understand how it can control energy and life force, those units which nourish all manifestations and appearances. Chapter 6, The Group Soul.